You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
I love this podcast. This is with Sandra Steinbrecher, who's a Chicago documentary photographer working on long-term assignments about education, the arts, and community development. But her new book of photographs and prose is called The Salt Shed, Transformation of a Chicago Landmark. So this is a venue in Chicago. It was the Morton Salt Shed. If you're driving on the Kennedy Expressway, you saw it. You guys all have Morton Salt in your kitchen, probably. And it's now this incredible music venue, both outdoor and indoor. And then Sandy, who I've known for 25 years, our kids went to daycare together. She did this brilliant book of photography, and it's more than pictures. And you'll hear that in the conversation. Enjoy the pod.
Another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Sandra Steinbrecher, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Callie. It's great that you invited me.
So, for the non-Chicagoans who listen to this podcast, can you paint a picture of how, for us locals, the Morton Salt Shed is such an iconic landmark of Chicago, at least our Chicago history?
Yeah, well, the Morton Salt Company Warehouse Complex, which is its actual official name, is nearly 100 years old. It was built in 1929. And soon after it was built, the Morton Salt logo was painted on the billboards. So it's been gracing this giant, oversized, you know, poster or billboard for our city for years. And now most of us have been driving on the Kennedy Highway, although that's wasn't built until 1960, or driving or bicycling by on Elston Avenue. And it was this sturdy, very familiar and beloved presence. It's this girl on the roof. She's, you know, she's a child and she's very welcoming. And we all have the salt in our cupboards. So it's this sense of familiarity and nostalgia, and then genuine interest. I think everybody wants to know, or did want to know, what's behind that billboard? What is going on in there? Yes, we know it was a salt processing facility. Salt came up the river and was, you know, delivered into the building and, you know, came out and went on our roads and went on our tables. But it held a sense of mystery. And I also actually would like to say it holds a sense of our place as a city in the Midwest, but also in the country and in the world. This was the foundation of our economic growth. You know, the lumber and meatpacking, salt industries, all of those were along the river. And so this place sits, you know, not on our jewel of a lakefront, which we all adore and love, and strangers and tourists love it, but along the Chicago River, which is our kind of maybe more like the backyard instead of the front yard, you know, and it holds the history of all the people who came through, who worked there way before the salt shed was there, but also during that nearly 100 years that Morton Salt built the place, moved it from downtown along the lake because of Lakeshore Drive going in, and then ended up there on Elston Avenue.
So it's so interesting. There's many stories with this book, and there's beautiful photography, of course, and there's really lovely prose. And the Morton Salt folks left that building in 2015, and our mutual friend Heidi Stevens wrote the foreword to your book. And I really love her writing, and I want to read this one paragraph that she has in the book. She goes, "What quote, we protect our past so we are connected to what came before us, so we understand what lies in front of us today and tomorrow. But for the past to be more than a ghost, an ephemeral, translucent thing, we need to be able to touch it, smell it, hold it in our hands. Our connection needs to be tangible, tactile. This is especially true of old buildings whose footprint and architecture and long list of purposes and inhabitants narrate our story to us," end quote. That is such a
Beautiful.
lovely, you're right. And I was just like 10 minutes ago, I was downstairs in front of the Second City Arches, which were part of the Garrick Theater from downtown Chicago, right? This is all around us for us Chicagoans. And the rarity is that this iconic place gets to be another iconic place because this became the Salt Shed music venue, which I go to all the time, and it is one of the great music venues in the city of Chicago.
Absolutely. It is probably going to be one of the great music venues in the country,
Yeah.
considered so. I did, towards the end of my photographing over there, get to witness the installation of some of the sound and lighting system. And I saw the highly technical process that was used. I saw the materials and how it was designed and built. I think it was about a 4-year process to build the sound, to design the sound system. The speakers are from France. They just really wanted to create a world-class venue. And I think what it does is probably one of the best ideas, really, for in terms of sustainability, which is one of my themes in the book, that we, not just that we save this building, it's, sustainability in the building industry, but then there's also the sustainability of the venue and that it can, create jobs and make money and bring people in. And so it's this vibrant second life, which is not always easy to do with an older building. And so I think it's a terrific example of what we can accomplish and what I'm hoping people will think about accomplishing in all their communities. And because cities everywhere have to consider how do we deal with our empty civic spaces, our abandoned buildings, can't tear them all down, don't want to. But what are the creative ways that we can save our buildings and create a sense of place and a sense of history and a sense of belonging within our communities? Because that really impacts our quality of life.
Yeah.
It's more than just saving an old billboard that we love. There's more to it, and those layers are nuanced, and I don't really know how to quantify it. I don't
Yeah.
know how we quantify that value, but you're so right. This venue is a fabulous place to go to. And also, I bet you could go there with, your son. And I bet you
Yeah.
can go there with, it's very multi-generational, and it is interesting to people of all generations and all backgrounds.
Yeah, I saw Jason Isbell play there, and Nick now lives in Atlanta. And we just made a deal, and I got tickets to see Jason at the Ryman. So it'll be we're, and he's going to meet me. He's got to take a bus from Atlanta to Nashville. Again, another icon. I've never been to the Ryman and the Grand Ole Opry in that area, and it's meaningful and all. And one of the things I was thinking about with regard to our conversation today and other conversations I've been having on this podcast recently, a lot of stuff about AI, but a lot of the things that we're talking about with AI is where the humans come in. So people recognizing that, this is none of this is going to work unless it works with humans. And then these places, because I just got pitched up an upcoming podcast I'm going to do around designing schools to be more effective and not like factories, because that model doesn't work anymore. And I just feel like this concept of the intersection of human beings, place, history, all of it It is many stories, but it is also one story because none of it exists in isolation. And I think, unfortunately, for a lot of humans, it's a little too much. You know, it's like there's so many moving parts for us to figure out. We're just trying to like wake up and pay our bills. So I get it, but you can't ignore it because it's around us. And especially for those of us who love Chicago, part of what we love about the city is this sort of weird interweaving of politics and culture and place and arts and sports and like and all of it, right? It's why the argument about deep dish pizza is always funny to me, because like anyone who's from Chicago just loves pizza in all its different forms. So we don't need to be arguing about it.
Well, I think you raised a good point about, I know it's a bit of a popular word, the intersectionality, but that's actually what I found. I couldn't believe how many themes were coming to the surface during my photography over there. And as you probably figured out, or I may have mentioned that after I was shooting photos for a while, I started talking to people and just interviewing, recording quick conversations on site with any workers who, had a minute or who would talk. And so I really started to get a deeper idea of what was going on there. And I felt like the human touch was a big theme that came up. So you just mentioned the human in all of this. And I think we think of our buildings and our construction as being done by, giant machines, which they are always, on a major construction site. And we don't realize, I think I didn't realize until I was there witnessing it, that, people are still, a giant steel beam might be placed, or lifted up by a crane, but people are placing it, moving it, welding it. And so human hands are on everything. And, the care that is taken with this kind of work, and then it gets buried, under layers of gravel or layers of concrete or paint. And so we see this beautiful space when it's redone, but we don't realize the sort of invisible, careful, beautiful work that was done as the foundation, how the water was brought in, what had to happen for that. The plumber, when I went underground with the plumbers and I see how they work in these tiny little spaces, confined spaces, and find the historic pipes and re retrofit things so that it will work with the new vision of the new owners. And I really wanted to honor that work and show what it takes to do it. And then there's also the vision, on the front end that someone had to have. That's not the manual labor, but it's the ideas and the vision. So people walked into this abandoned space, and you stand under all that steel, especially when it's kind of half open like that, or and the dust is swirling and the light is coming in. I think this is really the picture that maybe we were talking about at the beginning. And it's a 50-foot high, maybe football field-ish long, vast space of steel and light. And it's almost like a majestic experience without being in a natural environment. This is an industrial environment, but there is something kind of awe-inspiring and majestic about it. Certainly, I felt that way. And I think that's kind of what comes through in the photographs, is that I just couldn't get over how beautiful it all was. The river, the sun coming up, hitting the steel, the rusted steel in that early morning warm light, seeing the bridges and the skyline, and then the steel shed, and then being out on Elston Avenue. I went to every vantage point I could to try to capture the different points of view. And I just wanted people to see how beautiful it was, and also how powerful it is to see something be taken apart, rebuilt, restored, changed, and what it takes.
So I'm always curious about the process. So when you started out on this, was there a book in mind, or were you just going to take some shots and see what happened?
I have to tell you that this is the most organic project I've ever worked on. If that word is tells you anything, I don't know. Okay, this project started with me really just walking through the grounds and the buildings. I had permission to do that. I knew one of the owners, and once I heard they were starting to work on it, I just said, "Hey, can I walk through and take some photos?" And I thought I'd walk through, see the space, take some pictures. I had no idea I was going to even go back. And then I was told that the roof panels were coming down because they needed to be replaced with new ones. They were the originals. And the steel, some of the steel underneath had to be either rebuilt or replaced. And I thought, oh man, that is momentous. Like, we're Chicagoans. Like, that, those roof panels are coming down. I'm a documentary photographer, and I thought I gotta shoot that. So I asked if I could come back, and it was about a 2-week process for them to take it down, take the panels down, and I was hooked. I just started making relationships, and I just was compelled to keep going back. I still had no idea what I was doing. I was literally motivated by the visual stimulation all around me, and it was so interesting. I just kept photographing. Some months later, I realized there were so many stories. There was a story, a main story, and there were many themes. And that's when I started to think, well, I didn't know. I had a conversation with myself, Kelly. I said, you know, would I be okay if nothing happened with these photos and they ended up sitting in my archive? Would I be okay with that? And I said, yes, this is way too much fun not to do. I'm just going to do it. And then as time went on, you know, things gelled, ideas came to me. There hasn't been a day in 3 years, almost 3 years, that I haven't thought about it in some way, whether I was shooting it, in researching, interviewing people, talking to people, figuring it out, learning to write so I could write the chapter introductions in the book, and you know, taught learning to talk to people about it. So it's a lesson to me, actually, in following something and really being in touch with your own instinct. And I have to say, there was a bit of a feeling of being like a child because I felt like I was discovering something new. Of course, it isn't new at all, but for me, it was. And I felt like I had the capability to show it, you know, to show these visuals. So I hope that answers the question in terms of how it happened. It, you know, I wish I could say it was planned, but it wasn't.
No, it's better than it's not. I mean, this is the thing. When you're making something out of nothing, which is we're in the business of at Second City, you know, you have to surrender to the thing that's happening. And I, you know, the lesson I learned this way too late in my producing career, but I did learn it, which was like when you're outside of a thing that is being made or being done, your ability to control the things that are happening, it doesn't exist. But you can have an impact, and you can have a positive or a negative impact. And in what you did here very clearly was such a positive impact, because you didn't just simply document. You were feeling the thing, and that was coming through in the documentation, which is a very, very different thing. And I'm just curious too, like, this feels like you did you have to pitch it to many different publishers, or did you like find your publisher, they got it? Because it feels a little kismet that probably happened.
Yeah, it feels like things have just kept happening. There have been a few, what I'll call them, sort of closed doors, but in that sense, I just shifted and found other open ones. And
That's right.
so, the publisher, yes, I was introduced at, you know, talking it over with a friend of mine, Rich Cahan, who was very encouraging to me about the photographs. He has a small publishing company. He said, I don't think we're quite, the one for you, but how about, Trope? And so he introduced me to Sam Landers, the founder and one of the founders and publisher. And he said, sure, I'll be your publisher. So it
Okay.
does sound easy, but I think I had to learn how to talk about the project up until that time.
Yeah.
And I worked on that a lot.
Yeah.
So the pitch, you can't just pitch something first draft. Just nothing is a first draft, right?
Yep.
But I realized how I had already been, showing the photos and trying to figure out a succinct way to speak about the project and why it was relevant and why it's important. So, but yes, that was a wonderful connection, and they do books that are mostly photography and art, and I think they did a lovely job with the layout and design and with kind of understanding my experience and that it needed to be a more of a non-traditional photography book, and by that it had a lot of these stories, and so the stories needed to be told.
So one of my favorite chapters is the one on winter. And I would have assumed that work would have slowed down or even stopped during a Chicago winter. Was that your assumption as well?
Yes.
But that did not happen.
No, yes. Imagine my surprise when I realized, oh, everyone's still working. I guess I'll go out there too because,
Oh my God. January and February in Chicago?
yeah, there's still a lot that can happen. There are things that can't happen. Obviously, things like the concrete pours don't happen in that weather. But surprisingly, there is quite a bit that can be done. And of course, these projects are so, there's always a lot of, there's budgets involved and timing. And so things have to stay on track. So, yes, they do continue in the winter.
All right, I want to read. This is really lovely prose. You write, quote, "Along the river, the plumbing crew worked on laying pipes out in the snow. In late winter, they began to dig tunnels in the shed floor, preparing to install indoor plumbing for the venue's bars and bathrooms. One snowy morning, a barge appeared on the river, carrying welders to repair the street cleats along the seawall. The torch flames looked pink and blue in the frigid air." So you're a photographer, right? But then you had to solve the poetry to try to also say it through prose. Is that something you had done? I mean, you already said that you had to work on your writing.
I had written something a few years ago and worked on it with an editor, and so that gave me a little bit of confidence
Yeah.
to know that it was possible and to figure out how to kind of teach myself to do just what you said, which is to learn how to describe it in a way that would be effective. And I'm happy that you had the reaction you did, and just how to put things in words. But I did have a great editor, and actually two who looked it over, one very carefully, one who gave me actually I had three people look at the
Yeah.
writing, and then a copy editor for obviously the nuts and bolts of the to make sure it looked and sounded right too, but it is something that did not originally come naturally to me, but I actually got a lot of satisfaction out of it.
Yeah. In that same chapter, you note that one of the iron workers said, quote, "It's not how many years you have left, it's how many winters." Which is really a very powerful statement. And this moves into the people part of the book, which is, as I think I was a little surprised as so many women who were working on this project, right? In what is traditionally a male-dominated field, but also how many people this was generational. Their father did this, or their grandfather, and then you have plumbers calling their father or grandfather to get advice on something. I mean, that particular web seemed very satisfying as a storyline for the book.
Yeah, again, I felt like people were such a big part of the story that I wanted to make sure some of these small moments were captured. I felt like the the plumber that I worked with a lot, the plumbing foreman, Danny, was just had a big love of plumbing. Danny, could have done anything, had choices in life, but his father, grandfather, and uncle were all plumbers, and I think he didn't feel as much of, I will say, a bit of a responsibility, I think, to the name and to their quality of work, but more about it just he really has a love of it. And so he was able to work on this type of a building, and really, I guess it showed me that we don't always value the trades and people who work with their hands.
Right.
Our society tends to value, college educations and that kind of a path in life. But the way that, tradespeople, the way their brains work, the problem-solving abilities just kind of blew me away. I mean, it was really a lot of fun to watch. And, a lot of there was sort of, some disclaimers sometimes. So I would say to somebody, how did you get into this line of work? And they'd say, well, I wasn't good in school, or I didn't like school that much, or and I always liked working with my hands. And, so there was always that feeling like, well, I didn't match up with that kind of a path, so I'm taking this path instead of saying this is, a really great path. Although many tradespeople did say this is a great way to make a living. We are working on projects that are they're not always like this interesting in terms of, historic nature, but they're doing something, they're building something, they're creating something with their hands, and they see their work, they get the satisfaction of being able to see something from start to finish.
Yeah, that's
I will
tremendous.
say that there are not enough women and people of color on the jobs,
Yeah.
but that is seems to be changing. I checked some of the statistics or some of the percentages a couple of years ago when I was deep into it. It was maybe 6% nationally, and now I think it's up to in the teens or 20s. So I think
Oh.
things are changing for the better, and in fact that inspired me to seek out, women tradespeople, so I could kind of hear more of their stories and see what it's like to be in such a, in a male-dominated world and succeed.
That's right. So one of the things about this podcast that I feel very blessed that I get to do is I've spent my whole life working in creativity and innovation, not thinking about it that much until I wrote my book. But then with the podcast, it's sort of like, all right, what does this mean for everyone in all their different areas? So, and in interviewing the social scientists, many of them offer this advice that has come over time and time again, is like, put yourself in a different place. So when I talk about the like when Nick and I, when my son and I during COVID decided to find the best Italian beefs in Chicago and start ranking it, we would find ourselves in these neighborhoods on the Northwest Side that we would never go to. We're in Trump country of Illinois often because they make great Italian beef. No one was wearing masks back then, but it allowed us to see a different part of the city that we've always lived in, and then brought all other kinds of people to us. And it strikes me, and this I think is true of your other work as well, is you take yourself and your camera to a certain place, and then discover what that story is. And then the transaction that can take place, right, is whether other people get to experience that, because they never would have seen it. None of us would have, we would maybe driven by and seen a couple things happen. But what a gift that is for us, but also for you. And I imagine that's what you feel. That's a flourishing, if you will, or transformation.
It was a huge gift. It is still a huge gift. This is, first of all, it's the most fun I've ever probably had working. Some days I'd be up on a rooftop and I'd think, I'm just having so much fun. Or I listened back to some of the conversations I was having with tradespeople and I was laughing a lot. So I was remembering that it felt joyful to me to be there, to be able to see it. And then I do want to say it's really a rare opportunity to be a photographer, basically kind of embedded on a major construction site, and to be able to shoot freely, for storytelling narrative purposes, not for commercial purposes. And
Right.
so I have to give a huge thanks, and I did in the book and have many times, to the owners, to Craig and Bruce, who, gave me the permission to be there. This whole project would not be anything if they had said, no, it's too dangerous, or no, we don't need this. I mean, and then they left me alone. I would ask, like, do you need any types of shots? Is there anything you want me to do? And, everyone's too busy. They're building up, the giant, gorgeous music venue, and they have other things to do. They're not thinking, oh, we need, this whole process photographed, and it's going to be a beautiful book. So I've just left alone to kind of to do it. And that's why I think I said previously it was kind of the most pure project I've ever done, because I wasn't being paid. There was no money exchanging hands for this work. No one told me what to do. I had to make it. I had to discover it. I had to figure it out. If I came home and I didn't have the shots I wanted, I went back and I figured it out the next day. And if I wasn't in place, and then here's what it also taught me about we all know about this, right? The impermanence of life, right? Okay, well, on a construction site, I mean, that's every day. It changes. The ground literally shifts beneath your feet every day. One day you go and a stairway is open and you walk up those stairs. The next day you go, those are blocked off, or they've been cut down and there's no way in. A window will become, bricked up, and a doorway will, lead nowhere. So I was constantly having to figure out new ways to get to spaces where I could see. I could never stop or start work. Work went on, and it was up to me to figure out how to see it, how to get to where my camera could see it, how to stay safe, and how to try to tell the story. So it was an incredibly fun, difficult challenge that anybody would love to have something like this in their life. And so back to what you said, it was a huge gift. I still feel so excited and so happy that I got to do it.
Yeah, we don't. There's very little. People don't get prepped for getting older and all the things that happen with it, where you lose people, where you lose places. The rest, your favorite restaurant that closes. And it's gonna, and your pet is gonna die. All these things that happen. And there's maybe no way to prep for it. But then, for those of us who find, who need to go on and want to be creative with their lives and live fulfilling lives, this ability of finding there are births and deaths all around us in so many different ways. And if you can have an opportunity to make something new, sort of continually find ways to make something new, it is such an affirming way to live a full life. And that can be at work. I think it can be elsewhere. I think it's in the relationships you make often. Along the way, but it's so hard to capture in a way, and honestly, this book kind of does it. I know that's maybe not the purpose of it, but for me, and again, there's so many interlocking stories for us. We've known each other for how many years? 24, 25 years?
At least 25, yeah.
But 25 years, because our
Yeah.
kids are in daycare together,
That's right.
and so many stories in between there. And so what I love now is I'm sitting in my office at Second City on Well Street. Your book is on the coffee table in my office so that when people sit down, I can point to it and have them look at it. And, I wanted to ask you this. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. But what was the first concert you saw when you went to the shed?
Okay, so the first, very first concert was sort of a friends and family soft opening thing. But the first official one was, let's see, Angel Olsen, Julian Baker, who is now part of Boy Genius,
Yes, yeah.
and they won a Grammy or some Grammys this year. And I'll think of it in a minute, but
Yeah.
it was three women
Wow.
performances.
That's
And
great.
then either the next night or two nights after was Andrew Bird.
Okay.
And so this was the outdoor space.
Yes.
Inzor was still a
Being built.
it was still a construction site. And for those concerts, I kind of just ran everywhere. You know, you get when you shoot a show, you get three songs. The first three songs they let you shoot from the photographer's pit, which is at the front of the stage, the bottom. And any photographers who are there from media are shooting from the same spot. And so it's, you know, it's not super creative. It's what they let you do. But then I had like pretty much free rein to go to all different spots and get crowd shots. And then I would go up on my special roof spot. And so for Andrew Bird, I saw there was going to be a full moon and I stashed my tripod up there. And then when I would go up, I would get shots as the, you know, night was falling and the moon was rising. And so I got a full moon shot with the stage. And it was just one of those, you know, great moments where I thought, you know, everything is coming together, like photography and music and the arts and architecture and history, and see the glittering skyline, the full moon, the bridge, the Division Street Bridge, and then just all these people, you know, loving it, loving
Yeah.
being together, celebrating, just being in experiencing the arts. And so again, another like joyful moment where I, you know, you're working and you're sweating and you're thinking and you're hoping you get what you need, but also like the joy of work, the joy of all those things coming together and being with people too in the space. So that was a great intro to the performance aspect of the space. And then I will tell you that my last, you asked about the first, but my last
Yeah.
concert that I shot was Patti Smith.
Cool as hell.
Cool as hell. And so, what a great show. I mean, I've seen her before, but being there and then this crowd of all ages, you know, she's really got followers who are, you know, our age and older or, you know, kids. So it was a beautiful thing. And then again, with this project, which so many people are happy to be involved with or to talk to me about it. Her manager, you know, she allowed me to, in fact, all the artists in the book, there's a handful, not tons, but they make up a good section at the end, and they all agreed to let me use their photos. There was no
Right.
weirdness, no business, no, you know, it was just like, yeah, do it. So it's a testament, I think, to this space, the place it holds in people's hearts and memories, and that it's something that is important. And one of my main goals with this project now, and kind of always has been, but I didn't know how, I probably didn't know exactly in words, but you know, is to make historic preservation come alive for people, but especially for young people. And so this type of place, which caters to, you know, all ages, but where young people are really excited to be there, they can see what it's like to be in a historic building and why it's cool and why it's beyond cool, you know, why it matters, and to get used to feeling like, oh yeah, saving a space like this is important. You know, maybe I'll go back to my community and do something like this. Again, like trying to weave in the importance of why we do this. And I mean, we didn't even talk about, we don't have to talk about like the origin of the building and the its provenance that it has, you know, its architects were very famous architects of the time. And so I didn't even know that when I started. To be honest, I was just reacting to all the action and to the visuals and knowing that it had a place in my life and in Chicago's life, but I didn't realize that it actually is a very significant building. So the fact that it was saved is even sweeter.
So the building was completed in 1930. And what I didn't realize is that the actual factory was actually a small part of the Morton Salt Company. So they operated salt mines, distribution centers, and sales offices all over the country. So all this stuff is fascinating in terms of what that was. And you tell that sort of origin story, and then it goes into this other process. So it really is the full gamut. I also saw a female singer-songwriter. I saw Madison Cunningham, and she opened for Lake Street Dive. That was my first one outdoors. My last one, which was indoors, was the Psychedelic Furs and Squeeze, which I'm now showing my age.
Oh,
Both.
Patti Smith.
Yeah, I guess so. So all brilliant stuff. All right, we always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. This feels like a layup for you. Do you have a yes and story for us?
Well, Kelly, this whole project has been a yes and story. If you had said to me, if someone had said to me, go and shoot on a construction site for 2 years and then spend a year of your life doing a book, I probably would have said no. I mean,
No,
that's
thank you.
crazy. And it was crazy. And I love that about this project is that it was kind of crazy. I just followed my heart. I just said yes. People said yes. And so it's yes and on kind of so many levels. The owner said yes to me. The workers, sometimes there was a little bit of surprise. I don't want to say suspicion, but seeing a person with a camera. But, you return, you just show up, people start, thinking, oh, she's okay, or oh, that's cool. And they started liking, I think people don't photograph them very often.
Yeah,
People
that's
don't
right.
ask them about their work. Why are you doing this? What does it take? So everyone kind of said yes. And then, the publisher, and then, I had to figure out the financing for the book, and then found the Driehaus Foundation. And then, so it has been just such a great experience in terms of not thinking something is over, not closing yourself to possibilities. I didn't know how it would turn out. And is that risky? Yeah. But then I would think, well, what better way do I have to spend my time than taking photographs in this beautiful place in a city that I love?
Book is called The Salt Shed, Transformation of a Chicago Landmark. Sandy Steinbrecher, thank you for coming on the pod.
Oh, Kelly, this was so much fun, so many ways. Thank you.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox The Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.